St. Patrick's Day. Who's wearing green? Wow. Oh, you really are wearing green. And a hat to boot. Well, apparently I'm not very festive. I was told I don't have any green on, so sorry. I'll double up on, I'd wear your hat, but I don't want to do it right now. So anyway, we're doing a series that can take us to Easter. And why I think this is important is that I have a number of friends that aren't Christians. And for quite a few of them, one of their problems is they've been around Christians. And what's turned them off to faith is just the way they've seen, especially how Christians a lot of times are portrayed as just being judgmental of other people. How they look at them and they jump to conclusions. Some of you know what that's like, where you've been prejudged. And it seems like in the way we're oriented in our culture, it's real easy for us to form opinions of individuals and groups of people long before we ever get to know them. None of us like it when people do it to us, but we feel pretty comfortable doing it to others. So what we're going to do in this series is we're going to be examining how did Jesus look at other people, all different kinds. Today we're looking at people that are wealthy and connected. There'll be a variety of others you can look online, or there it may be in the program, but just different categories of people, and how did he treat them? How did he speak to them? How did he think about them? How did he approach them? Because that's really where we ought to be lining ourselves up with. And if we do it the way he did, rather than being a distraction to others, we might actually attract them to a God that cares about them and loves them and is concerned about bad choices, but he doesn't write people off because they make bad choices. So anyway, I hope you'll stick with this, and if you miss one of these weeks, you can go online and get it. I'm going to do a couple of preface things for this message, and the first is how you and I choose to regard other people says more about us or me than it does them. So when you leave here today, when you're out in the atrium, when you're driving home, when you're at the grocery store, whatever you do today, you're going to see some people and you're going to come to judgments about them. You're going to have in your thought bubble, you're going to be thinking about those kind of, like the ones that drive and pull out in front of you, the ones that are checking you out, or we have opinions about people. You're going to hear people talk about people. You hear people post about those kind of people. And it comes across, I mean, it's a real way to tell kind of what kind of attitude do I have. Do I tend to be prejudiced toward groups of people, or am I open-minded? Do I see somebody that represents a group and I say, I don't know this person, though. Am I prejudiced, open-minded? It's a choice that I get to make. Do I jump to generalizations and stereotypes of people by the way they look, the way they sound? Or am I willing to say, I'd really like to learn what they're about? Am I going to take some time to invest in them? Do I approach others with a sense of pride and arrogance? Or is there a sense of humility in me that recognizing that we're all kind of cut from the same cloth? These are really, really important. An example that most of us are aware of is Brendan Tarrant. This guy is an Australian that was in New Zealand, and he hates the idea of these Muslim immigrants not being in the Middle East. They've come to New Zealand, and so he decides he's going to make a big statement. So he puts a camera on, he arms himself, and he kills 50 people that are praying, worshiping, many of them kneeling. And he does it because he hates the idea. He said, I don't hate Muslims. I just hate the fact they're not where they belong. They ought to go back to where they belong. He's also a white supremacist. He believes that whites are infinitely more valuable and more important than non-whites. So there's an attitude that he's adopted, and it's been fed in a variety of ways. I'm not excusing anything. What he did is horrible. But there's also some things that have gone on to feed that attitude. And if you and I are honest, We have some of that kind of stuff that floats around us. It's kind of pride, arrogance. It's a sense of maybe I'm better or they're worse or whatever it is. And somehow I need to filter what I'm thinking. And if I'm a follower of Jesus, what that means is I adopt his attitude toward people. So in this series, we're going to look at a wide variety of kinds of people Jesus interacted with and how he treated them. What did he think about them? How did he show them respect? Did he ignore them? How did he do it? Because as a follower, what I need, I look at his example and I adopt that as my own. And Jesus shows us how to view people the way God does. He shows us how do I approach those. It may be people that irritate me or frustrate me or I don't understand. He shows me how to handle that. Reading the Bible, it's amazing because it exposes us, especially the first four books of the New Testament. These are the biographies of Jesus. It lets me see some things that I can really learn from. It's fascinating. At times, it's a little unnerving because I catch myself, if I'm not careful, boy, Jesus thinks differently than I do. You know, Jesus would hang around the in crowd, but he was very, very comfortable with being those that were the outcasts. And he didn't treat either one differently. He would hang around the powerful, people that had connections and all this, but he was also willing to be with those people that had absolutely no social clout at all. He was willing to be around the very religious, and in some cases, the pseudo-religious or kind of self-righteous, but he was also very comfortable being with those people that understood, I am very far, 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 far away from God. He would hang out with people that he was friends with, but he was also willing to approach his enemies. There are ways that he treated people that you and I can learn from, and if we claim to be followers of Jesus, this is one of those things that we need to be willing to adjust our attitude to line up and match with his. The first group we're looking at are those that are wealthy and connected. When I talk about wealthy, I'm talking about financially wealthy. The term wealthy, the definition, if you look at Webster's, is something along the lines of prosperous. Prosperous, having an abundance, having more than you need to survive. When I was in a group of us went to Africa, we have teams that go every year, and a few years back I went with a team, and we got to Uganda. One of the guys that went with us is a large guy, north of 300 pounds. And whenever we'd show up in a village, people were oohing and awing over him because he was obviously very prosperous. He weighed, I mean, not making fun of him, he weighed twice what the average men in those villages weighed. And they're thinking, this guy is very, very wealthy to afford to have the kind of income, to have the kind of food that he has. And it was a sign of success. Wealth is a clear sign. And answer this question, however you would answer it or someone else. Wealth is a clear sign that what? Wealth is a clear sign that what? Okay, wake up. Someone's wealthy, it's a clear sign of what? No, they have money. Okay, what else? They work hard. Okay, they're prosperous. What else? They inherited it. Or they won the lottery, so they're wealthy this week. What else? Someone's wealthy, it's a sign that person is what? Happy, okay? There are actually studies about this, that people that are wealthy in the sense of having more than they need are a little bit happier than people that don't. And the main reason is because they're not worried about whether they're going to have a roof over their head that night or they're going to have their next meal. So there's not a direct correlation of being super happy, but there is a sense of they have a relief because they're not constantly worried about survival. What else? Yeah, definitely a higher status. What else? You're a very dull bunch. I had someone in the 9 o'clock service said, well, they're jerks. Wealthy people are jerks. Or they're arrogant. Or they're proud. Or they think they're better than we are. They're uppity. All I know about wealth is this. Wealth is a clear sign that someone has wealth. I don't know of any other judgment that you can make on it. And now, actually, some people that look like they're wealthy and they're not, because it's all borrowed, but let's just assume that's not the case. If someone's wealthy, it's just a clear sign that they're wealthy. There's not any, there's really not anything else you can say. And I'm going to give you a couple of numbers here that might help you recognize whether you're wealthy or not. The median household income in the United States in 2017, $62,000. Median household income. $62,000. The median household income in Virginia, $72,000. So a lot of other places in the country think we're wealthy because we've got significantly more than they do in median household income. If you live in Prince William County, the median household income in Prince William County is $98,000 a year. So what is that, 50% more than the average median household income in the country? Fairfax County, $119,000 a year, median household income. That means there's plenty above, plenty below. We are number 9 or number 10, it varies, in the world of median household income. Uganda, if you're have the median household income in Uganda, which is like number 80th in the world of the cities that they or the countries they studied, the median is $400 a year. So this idea of wealth, it really is relative to your reference points. Considered worldwide, we are very wealthy. We have more than we need. There's some research that says we waste almost half the food that we have. We actually throw it away. It spoils. We don't use it. You see this in restaurants all the time. So I'm talking about in wealth, I'm talking about people that come across like they have a lot more than you and I do. And what do we do with that? And in the current state that we're in right now, in the next couple of years, we have people running for high office, and they're going to be talking about the wealthy. And in many cases, they're going to see the wealthy as either benefactors to them to help them win their office, or they're going to be the ones that we're going to tap into so they can pay off national debt and other kind of things that we need. I mean, and the wealthy will be this category of people. And the problem is once we start stereotyping a group of people, we can run in trouble just because we don't like people to stereotype us. It's easy to have happen. But I want to mention three things that wealth does not do. Did my microphone just go off for a minute? I was just checking. We're doing some testing to see if there's some feedback. So every once in a while, here, I got this felt pad on here that's really cool. You didn't need to know that. So here's some things wealth doesn't do. The first thing is it does not make someone more or less valuable than anyone else. Now, if you watch news cycles, if you watch reports and all this kind of stuff, you would think that the wealthy and connected people are really the most important because that's where most of the targets are. That's where most of the people we hear stories about. You and I know more about some of these wealthy and connected people than we do our own families. We hear about it all the time. We give them a lot of attention. Some of them pay to have that attention. They like that. But the bottom line is that wealthy and connected people are no more or less valuable than anybody else. And we know that because this is what Jesus tells us. He didn't treat them as more important, less important. He didn't stereotype them. He didn't write them off. I mean, he just treated them. They're people that just happen to have more wealth. That's the bottom line. Being wealthy also is not an indicator of God's favor. In many cultures, this has continued to be, if someone is wealthy, that's the sign that somehow God has favored them. And there are times when God will give somebody extraordinary wealth and you can tell that God's part of that because they use their wealth to help others. They become a funnel for that. But the fact that someone has a lot of wealth does not in and of itself mean anything. There are people in my profession that have tried to sell for generations. They've tried to sell this idea, if you just follow God the right way and send me money, he's going to make you wealthy. You'll get a better car, better house, you're going to have better circumstances and all that, as if somehow that's what God's most interested in. If that were the case, Jesus wouldn't have padded around in sandals, he would have been riding a Bentley. And you can say, well, they didn't have Bentleys then. He's the creator of everything. He could have created any. He could have Rolls, Bentley. He could have had whatever. He could have had Teslas. The fact is we have this image of wealth, and maybe that's somehow God's special blessing. Not necessarily at all. There are also some in my profession that, to their shame, court people that are wealthy and connected. And the big reason they do it is because they want some of it. They want some of that wealth. They want some of the influence that goes along with it. And again, look at Jesus' life, and that's not how he treated people. He didn't denigrate the wealthy, but he also didn't spend all his time with them as if that was the most important thing. And the other thing that wealth does, it does not insulate you from problems. It may help eliminate some. There may be, you know, you're not worried about, am I going to have another meal here, or am I going to be able to survive the next few years? But wealth in and of itself doesn't, it creates other problems. Watch the news this past week. You've got some athletes making a lot of money that are in a lot of trouble. They've got money, and it may have even helped create the problem, because they maybe think they're above the law. You've got a big team owner that's in trouble from some things he has done. You've got personalities that were big high flyers that are now getting ready to spend time in public housing that our tax dollars pay for, because they had opportunities that came maybe because of their wealth, but they made poor choices in that problem. But there are all these things that happen. I mean, how many times do you catch yourself at the grocery store, in Wegmans or one of these places, and you can't wait to look at those magazines that show, you know, wealthy people that have put on a ton of weight? Oh, I like seeing that. Hugh Jackman, he actually weighs 500 pounds. Or they're having family trouble. Or their accountant got him in trouble. You know, we think, oh, I really like that. I like to see them get what they deserve. Well, there's a problem with you and me when we do that. But the fact is that wealthy people they're not immune to these kind of things happening. In fact, they have some other things they have to deal with that you and I don't. There are a number of people that I've known that were wealthy that they were really skittish. They always wondered if someone's trying to be their friend because they really care about them, or if they care about being able to get something from them. I know a number of them that have been used, where people have courted their favor just because they're thinking. I've got a friend, he's fairly well off. No one that goes out to dinner with him ever offers to pay, because he's the wealthy guy. There's something about that is wrong. And what we need to do is recognize that being wealthy, yeah, there are some advantages, but there are disadvantages that go along with it too. And I want to tell you a story today about a guy. I debated on this, and I landed on this one because it's a unique story, and it's Jesus interacting with someone that was very wealthy, very influential, and what him not drawing a conclusion or jumping to a stereotype shows something that is fascinating. This is from Luke 7. Jesus had been teaching, and he was heading back. Capernaum was his main base. This is where he would regularly cycle back to. This as his home base. It said, when Jesus finished saying all this in the hearing of people, he entered Capernaum. There, a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and was about to die. Now, a Roman centurion, they were really the backbone of the Roman military. They were the commanders that really made everything happen. This guy was, in fact, Rome was occupying the nation at the time, so they were the big power group that were there. This Roman centurion was probably the most powerful, the most influential, and possibly the most wealthy person in all of Capernaum. And so the fact that he's there is significant. The fact that he cares about this servant is really interesting. In that time, you didn't have equal rights and all this kind of stuff. A servant was, in a lot of ways, treated kind of like office equipment. If malfunctioned and wasn't working well, you just replace them. And there was no social infrastructure for them. But this centurion, it's saying his servant was sick, about to die, and the master valued him highly. We're learning something about this wealthy, rich Roman that is kind of counter type. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come heal his servant. when they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. This man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. So this centurion, he's not a Jew. As a Roman, he would have had multiple gods, and he may have been godless. We don't know that. I mean, he knows Caesar was number one, but he could have had all kind of other religious kind of expressions. He's heard about Jesus. We don't believe they've ever met. And he believes, I've got to do whatever I can because I care about my servant, probably his family, and I want him well. And so he sends a delegation of elders from the local religious community, Jewish community there, to go and talk to Jesus, thinking, well, Jesus is Jewish, they are. I'll bet they could have some influence with him. And he sends them, and they come to Jesus, and it's interesting. They say, this guy deserves your help. He loves our nation, which is, again, that wasn't normal. The Romans, they occupied. They didn't necessarily care two bits about the nation. They just wanted to get their job done. This guy loved the nation, and he built them a synagogue. And my guess is he built them a really nice one. And their motive could have been they just cared about this guy. Maybe they cared about the servant. Their motive could also have been, boy, if he already built his one synagogue, no telling what else he'll do. We'll do whatever we can to make this guy. They may not have cared two bits about Jesus. Most of the religious leaders then didn't. They saw him as a threat. But these guys have come on the centurion's behalf, and he deserves your help. He loves our nation. He's built us a synagogue. You need to come and help this guy. Jesus did not do what would be so common today. He didn't say, a Roman centurion? Those guys are all scumbags. They're from Rome. They're godless, they're hateful, they're mean, they're power grubber. I mean, look what they've done economically to our country. They've taxed us beyond what we can handle. They're horrible. I'm not going to go do anything with this guy. But he didn't do that at all. In fact, he didn't respond. He just says this. So Jesus went with them. It says he was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, Lord, don't trouble yourself. For I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. This guy defies the stereotype. He did not come to Jesus personally. He sent the elders. Then he sent some friends. And he had the friends say, look, I know I don't deserve for you to come. I mean, this guy was a soldier of the top ranks. He had probably, I talked to a friend after the last service, probably had killed many. A lot of blood on his hands. He was an outsider. He was from another nation. I mean, he recognized who he was, and he was comparing that to Jesus. I don't deserve. These guys may have said I deserve. I don't deserve it at all. He goes on to say, he says, for I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I tell one go and he goes. And that one come and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. So he understands this idea of authority, understands allegiance, and this is what happens then. He goes, and Jesus, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. There are only two times in the New Testament where we hear that Jesus was amazed. One time was when there was a group of people that had all the spiritual background, and they should have recognized who he was. They should have seen that what he was saying was actually fulfilling the prophecies that had been given years and generations before, but they ignored him and they hated him, and they eventually wanted him killed. He was amazed at their unbelief. In this case, there's a Roman guy, has absolutely zero background, and he's amazed at this guy, not for his unbelief, but for his humble surrender, his faith. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel. Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. Jesus hasn't even met the guy yet, but he knows enough about him to draw this conclusion, that this is a man of great faith, defying the stereotypes and the caricatures. And he treats him with the kind of respect that wouldn't all of us want that. The thing about the centurion that I want to take just a few more minutes with this, is the centurion, while he was wealthy and connected and all this kind of thing, had great power, had something very much in common with his servant who was sick and dying. They, as far as God was concerned, they were on the same level playing field. They had different accomplishments, different status socially and all this, but the one thing that they had is the one thing Jesus wanted, and that is humble surrender to him. Everyone comes the same way. If you look at the way the Bible, and the Bible is great at answering the questions about why the world is what it is. Like over here, we really do live in a broken world. And it's easy to see it. I mean, we see the shooting in New Zealand, which is horrible, but we see things all the time. We see where things are just not the way they're supposed to be. But at the same time, we do see beauty. Like if you go to New Zealand, I've not been there. I've got friends that have gone on bike tours there and all that. You've got these snow-capped mountains. You've got the ocean. You've got beaches. It's a beautiful place. People love going there. So this is the kind of world we live in. God designed a beautiful world. And there's beauty all around us, but there's also this brokenness too. And sometimes we see it almost in the same moment. I was driving on 95 coming back from seeing my mom and dad this past week in this beautiful countryside, and then I come across this horrible wreck. Someone didn't do something right, and there's devastation right there. I mean, we're surrounded by it. And so God created this great world. It's broken, and the reason for that is my sin and yours. We decide we want to do things our way. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it. And unfortunately, what happens is there are consequences to it, and that leads to brokenness, both internally for me. I was at a, embarrassed to say it, but I will. I was at a CVS. I was helping my mom. She got some sunglasses, and they were all scratched. Mom needs new sunglasses. Where do you go to get sunglasses? Well, CVS, of course. Go to CVS, and they got this rack with all kind of sunglasses on it. And I say, pick out whatever you want, I'll get you. And so she picks out these Tommy Bahama. I don't know who Tommy is, but apparently he makes good sunglasses. And so she gets a pair of Tommy Bahama sunglasses. We go to check them out. There's no price tag on it. And the lady behind the counter says, well, can you go back and get me another pair, and I'll just use that price. So I go back and look at this thing of all kind of sunglasses. Some of them are hideous. Some of them are okay. But I start noticing price tags. Mom got the most expensive ones. There was one other pair of these Tommy Bahama ones, and then there was mom's that didn't have the tag. I could have taken one of the cheaper ones and just said, well, this is what I found, and I could have saved a whopping $7. The embarrassing thing for me is I was debating it. $7. And that lady sent me back here to look. How much is my time worth? I was going through this thing in my mind because I was willing to sell my birthright for $7, my integrity. Now, I will tell you, in this particular case, I took her back the large price and I sucked it up and left and grumbled for an hour. But we try to figure out, I mean, we're broken and we try to figure out, like, maybe I'm thinking I can get some credit because I paid the extra $7. That makes me a good guy. But it doesn't really change my brokenness. A friend of mine that I went to high school with just donated $50 million. Can't believe no one's asking me for that. $50 million to a school. It's a really good thing he did. But that doesn't change this. It doesn't change what's going on internally with us. It doesn't change our relationships. It doesn't change the brokenness we have in our country or in our world or our planet. We're still broken, and brokenness can't fix brokenness. That's why when we look through the Bible and we see what Jesus did is God knew we were broken. He designed us. He wanted us to have this great relationship with him and with each other. We screwed it up. And he wanted us to have, and so he did for us what we could never do for ourselves in a million years and all the nice things we do and trying to counter out all that kind of stuff. And what we learn from this Roman centurion is this. The elder said, oh, this guy deserves it because he loves our nation and he built a synagogue. That doesn't cure it. The only way that I'm going to be changed from my brokenness is to do what that centurion did, and that is to recognize I don't deserve this and to humbly surrender to Jesus. Say, God, I recognize that Jesus came to do for me what I couldn't do, and I'm accepting what he did so I can have forgiveness, I can be restored, and I can understand how you created me. I can rebuild my life from a broken mess, and be restored to what you designed me to be. When I become a follower of Jesus, the whole goal is for me to learn how to live this new life and to become the person God intended. That's why I read my Bible. That's why I try to apply. That's why we meet together as a church and try to help each other to, what does God say about this? Not trying to lobby so God will be on my side, but for me to be willing to say, humbly surrender, say, God, boy, I got some screwy ideas, and help me to match them up with what your ideas are. And then we, not only are we becoming restored, but then we get to be on this mission to help others see the same thing, that we're all broken and we all need what God did through Jesus. And that's what restores us. That's going to restore us individually in our families and our cultures. The centurion got it. And that's what amazed Jesus. James 4:10 says, humble yourselves before the Lord and he will lift you up in honor. What we learn from this wealthy guy that could have easily been stereotyped and caricatured is one of those, was that this humble surrender changes everything. And it leads us to having our lives restored in a way that puts us in a position and a relationship with God that is right and real. And it gives us the capacity now to live these new lives and help others understand just how approachable God is and what he offers. You can learn something from even a wealthy Roman. Let's pray together. God, it is easy for us to fall prey to the voyeurism of our culture, to look at groups of people and individuals and to label them and to have categories for them that box them in certain ways where we miss what they're really like. And even if they're corrupt and they have all kind of things wrong, that we miss the fact that you've offered grace. And you don't give us what we deserve, you'll offer us what we need. And forgive us when we forget that that's how we came to you too. I ask that you would help us to, the next time we see some of these people that are wealthy and connected, people that it'd be easy to draw conclusions about them, that rather than quietly celebrating when things don't go well for them, that we would begin praying for them. That if we have people around us that are wealthy and affluent, that rather than trying to cater to them so we can get in on it, that we would choose to love them and care about them and recognize that they have the same kind of brokenness that we do. It may manifest itself differently, but they still need to be made right with you. God, help us to adopt Jesus' values, his attitudes, and his behavior so that we can give people a picture of what you're like when they see us. We ask this in his name and for his sake. Amen.